The House Health and Social Services Committee meeting. Committee will now come to order. It is 3:22 on Tuesday, March 14th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Keto, Representative Edgeman, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones for the duration of this meeting. Representative Sullivan Leonard has just joined us. I'd like to thank Butch Carver, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Alex Beattie Goodiche from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today, as well as Ted Madsen, who is our committee aide. Today we'll be hearing two bills. First up is House Bill 103 relating to the practice of optometry. My staff will also be going over a blank committee substitute and will be taking invited testimony and then setting the bill aside for consideration on Thursday. Second, we'll be hearing House Bill 174 extending the declaration of disaster emergency relating to the opioid epidemic. There were two other measures scheduled today, HB 54 and HCR 2. However, due to time constraints imposed by the floor session, we're going to be holding those over for another date. So now I would like to ask my staff, Bernice Nesbitt, to come forward, and she's going to present HB 103. But first, I'm going to give some brief introductory remarks regarding the purpose and intent of the bill. The HB 103 gives authority to the Board of Optometry to regulate the practice of optometry, much as it's done by doctors, nurses, midwives, and other professional healthcare practitioners throughout the state. It assures that the Board of Optometry will have the opportunity to update their educational standards, continuing education standards, and scope of practice based on the best practices and available evidence. The bill will not allow optometrists to provide services outside of their scope of practice, like performing surgeries. What it will allow for is for the Board of Optometry to utilize the regulatory process to manage themselves, just as doctors, nurses, and midwives do. There is a robust process in place, which a representative of the Department of Law will detail later, that ensures thoughtful consideration and opportunity for public testimony and input on any changes to educational standards and or scope of practice that might be considered or proposed by the Board of Optometry in the future. It is my hope that this bill will get the legislature out of the business of managing optometry in the state of Alaska so that we can focus our efforts and energies on issues which do require our attention specifically and instead relegate these decisions, I believe, to those that are most qualified to manage the process, and that would be optometrists themselves, protected by our careful regulatory system that we have set up in our state. So that's sort of my initial thoughts about HB 103. And now I'm going to ask Ms. Nesbitt to introduce herself for the record, present the bill, and the changes that were made in the proposed blank committee substitute. However, first we're going to need a motion to bring the committee substitute forward as a working document.
Madam Chair, I move that the Health and Social Services Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 103, Work Order Number 30-LS0459/D, and adopt that as a working document.
All right. Thank you, Representative Edgeman. I will object for the purposes of discussion. I also want to recognize that Representative Johnston has joined us. Ms. Nesbitt?
Good afternoon. My name is Bernice Nesbitt, and I'm staff to Representative Sponholz, and I will be going over HB 103. The intent of HB 103 is to improve and update the Alaska optometry statutes. As they stand now, they are over 40 years old. HB 103 gives the Board of Optometry the authority to regulate its practice and to update their standards of practice. It also allows the Board of Optometry to regulate their continuing education requirements. Most importantly, HB 103 ensures that optometrists who are licensed to practice in Alaska will practice to the standards to which they are trained, educated, and experienced. And lastly, the definition of optometry is updated to reflect current and modern-day practice. There are several changes that were made from HB 103 version A to committee substitute version D. In section 1, it focuses on regulations within the Board of Optometry, which will give them the ability to develop uniform standards of practice for optometry and prescribe pharmaceuticals for the treatment of eye disease. The most significant change in Section 1 is that we've taken the language, which is ophthalmic surgery and non-invasive procedures, out of Section 1. In Section 2, I'd like to draw your attention to line 13 on page 1, where it says Section 11, Chapter 25, SLA. This is referring to the Medicare Reform Bill that was passed in 2016. And this statute has been amended to add number 4, which states that the Board of Optometry will publish advisory opinions regarding the standards of practice of optometry. I'd also like to point out that on page 2, line 5, AS17.30.200, subsection O, is referring to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. In section 3, this states that a licensee shall submit to the board evidence that they have been that they have completed their continuing education hours during the preceding licensing period. In section 4, subsection A, this has been repealed and the new language is updated to allow licensees to prescribe and use pharmaceuticals in the practice of optometry. In section 5, this is a new section that adds a limitation on practice for a licensee of optometry, and the services or procedures that a licensee is able to perform need to be within their scope of education, training, and experience that have been established by the Board of Optometry. Then in Section 6, Subsection 3, this has been repealed, and new language updates the definition of optometry. And lastly, Section 7 refers back to Section 2, which is the effective date of July 17th, 2017. That completes the end of this analysis for CS of HB 103. If you have any questions regarding this bill, I'd be happy to try and answer them now.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. Just in brief, what do you think is the biggest problem with current law that this bill addresses?
Representative Eastman, we're still working on distinguishing the CS from the original amendment, and we need to, I believe, adopt it before we can proceed.
Follow up?
Proceed.
What do you think the biggest problem is that's being addressed by the CS?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think the biggest issue the CS resolves is the term ophthalmic surgery and non-invasive procedures, which we've taken out.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any objection to, So with the changes explained by Ms. Nesbitt, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection to adopting the CS. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS? All right, seeing none, we're going to adopt it, and I would like to turn to invited testimony. I'd like to first ask Dr. Paul Barney with the Board of Optometry to come forward. Thank you, and if you could introduce yourself and your association for the record before your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Barney. I'm an optometrist and the current chair of the Alaska Board of Examiners in Optometry. I'm also a past president of the Alaska Optometric Association, and I'm here today in support of HB 103. A little bit about myself. I've practiced in Anchorage for 17 years, where I'm the center director of the Pacific Cataract and Laser Institute in Anchorage. Pacific Cataract and Laser Institute, also known as PCLI, is a referral center limited to medical and surgical eye care. I practice with an ophthalmic surgeon, a certified registered nurse anesthetist, PCLI's approach to eye care is to work collaboratively as a team and optimize each practitioner's education and skills. Together, we're able to provide quality, affordable surgical eye care to Alaskans. And in fact, we're the largest provider of cataract care in the state of Alaska. I support HB 103 because it will allow the Board of Optometry to regulate the details of the practice of optometry. This is already the case with advanced practice nurses, dentists, and medical doctors. This legislation will not set new precedents in healthcare, since this is already the way other healthcare providers are regulated in the state of Alaska. HB 103 will give optometrists a better opportunity to practice to the highest level of their education by allowing the Board of Optometry to write regulations that are commensurate with educational advances that occur with new technology and medications. The current optometry statute was written over 40 years ago and requires optometry to pursue a statute change whenever there are advances in education and technology. And as you know, statute changes are costly and time-consuming. Like all other professional regulatory boards, the Board of Optometry cannot promulgate regulations for practices or procedures that are beyond the education of optometrists. The Board of Optometry is overseen by the Alaska Department of Law, just like other healthcare boards. Excuse me. And the Alaska Department of Law would ensure that the Board of Optometry's regulations were within the scope of optometric education. Other safeguards are our medical legal system and the insurance system. Any healthcare provider who provides care outside of their education is subject to disciplinary action by their respective board, as well as serious medical legal ramifications. Additionally, insurance carriers do not pay providers for care they provide outside of their scope of education. With that said, there's no incentive for any healthcare provider to provide care outside of their education, and there are very serious consequences both financially and to their licensure to practitioners who provide care outside of their education. As chair of the Alaska Board of Optometry, I can assure you that the primary concern of the board is the safety of the public. In the 6 years that I've served on the board, we've had no complaints from the public that were serious enough to consider disciplinary action. Optometrists in general are conservative and cautious practitioners. Passage of HB 103 would not change their conservative nature. HB 103 would be good for the state of Alaska. The bill puts the regulatory details regarding the practice of optometry in the authority of the Alaska Board of Optometry. These changes are important to allow the profession and the practice of optometry to incorporate new technologies and advances in eye care as they occur. Optometry provides approximately 70% of the eye care in the U.S. In some rural areas, especially in Alaska, optometrists are the only eye care provider in the community. The citizens of Alaska deserve to be served by a profession that is allowed to stay current with advances in education and new technologies in eye care. I respectfully urge you to support HB 103. Thank you.
Is there any questions for Dr. Barney? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, please, sir. On page 2 of this bill, line 15, it talks about completed 7 hours of continuing education approved by the board concerning the injection of non-topical therapeutic pharmaceutical agents. Could you expand on that a little bit, on what an optometrist may be working on to have this in statute?
Representative, through the chair, optometrists do minor procedures that may require anesthetics, injected anesthetics, also things like a sty on the lid. We might inject that with a steroid. So there are times where injections are necessary. If you're referring to why the recurring every 4 years, that was put into statute. That was not something that the profession of optometry wanted, but it was a consolation, if you will, that was that was made at the time the statute was written. And one of the reasons for HB 103 would be to clean those things up and allow the Board of Optometry to decide what the educational requirements are. In this particular case, a legislator had decided that that was necessary. And in reality, it probably isn't.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there any other questions for Dr. Barney? All right. Thank you, Dr. Barney.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak today.
All right, and hopefully you'll stay in the room just in case there's additional questions that come up.
I will.
All right. Can I ask Dr. Jeff Gonison to come up? And in the same manner, introduce yourself and any associations you might have for the record before you testify.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Gonison. I'm representing the Alaska Optometric Association as a legislative chair. I was born and raised in Ketchikan and Craig, and I was the first Alaska Native optometrist. I've served on the state optometry board under two different governors and as past president of the Alaska Optometric Association. I volunteered at Alaska Native Medical Center and South Central Foundation. You have a support letter from Catherine Gottlieb of South Central Foundation in your packet. I practice in Anchorage, and I performed bush clinics in my younger days. I've actually been to Tutitlic, Yakutat, Cordova, Valdez, Kotzebue, Bethel. Anyway, a little information for those of you new to the issue. Optometry's doctor's degree was brought up to the same level of education as medicine and dentistry over 45 years ago. 4 years of undergraduate bachelor's degree, followed by a 4-year graduate professional doctoral program, plus often 1 to 2 years residencies for advanced education. This exactly follows the dental school model. You're looking at 8 to 10 years of university education. And by the way, currently 2/3 of the nation's optometry students are women. The 4 learned professions of medicine, dentistry, optometry, and advanced practice nurses are all independent, all have their own regulatory boards, and are all currently authorized by Alaska law to prescribe drugs, including controlled narcotics, with DEA numbers. Alaska optometrists have prescribed drugs for the past 25 years with no issues of harm or abuse. Optometrists are defined as physicians by the Federal Center for Medicare and are held to the same standard of care as other medical professions as we treat Medicare and Medicaid patients, and we are on preferred provider insurance panels. The optometry malpractice insurance fee is extremely low, about $485 per year for $4 million of coverage. Now, approximately 150 optometrists practice all over the state and provide the vast majority of eye care in Alaska, servicing over 80 remote locations. Local optometrists are called upon at rural hospitals and clinics for their expertise. We are the primary care physicians for eye care in Alaska. Treatment and travel costs from rural areas are greatly increased when routine eye care is instead provided by urban specialists. Alaska needs the best new doctors of optometry, and antiquated state statutes are a barrier to attracting the best and brightest to our state. Now, to be absolutely clear, House Bill 103 does not authorize any optometrist to do anything. It only updates antiquated statutes and gives the State Optometry Board authority to regulate the profession with the sworn duty to protect the public, the same as Alaska medical physicians, dentists, and advanced practice nurses, so that optometry does not have to come back to the legislature every time for some new change in education or technology. Now, the legislature creates professional boards to regulate the specific details of practice, as you've heard, that allows for flexibility with advances. Most importantly, licensing includes professional judgment of when to refer patients for specific specialty care. This bill has nothing to do with comparing the advanced subspecialty ophthalmology training with optometry. The clinical education of an optometrist does not have to parallel that of an ophthalmologist. any more than a family doctor needs to parallel a heart surgeon or a neurosurgeon. The family doctor has no restrictions, but does not perform heart or brain surgery, as they refer to these specialties. Optometry does the same. The State Optometry Board would never authorize any optometrist to perform any treatment they were not educated and qualified to do. Risk of harm to the public has never been an issue, and all these claims of public harm are patently untrue. Of the four main prescribing professions, only optometry still contains outdated statutes. The Alaska Optometry Board deserves the same level of respect as the other professions and not be constrained by its competitors. I respectfully ask for your support, House Bill 103, to allow Optometry Board to better regulate for the future, to benefit Alaska citizens by providing better access to eye care and lower costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gonison. Representative Johnston, you have a question?
Yes, you brought up an interesting point, that you're saying that your malpractice insurance is only $450 a year?
And $485 annually.
And why is that so much lower than other malpractice?
Because we're very conservative and get sued much less.
So it's the actuarial?
Yes, actuarial tables. Because the eye is so precious, we're very, very careful on what we do with the eye. And so our malpractice rates are very, very low.
And that's across the board?
Yes, all 50 states. It varies. What's interesting is that the malpractice rate's a little higher in states with more lawyers, and yet they have less privileges than we have in optometry. But the states that have higher privileges than we have, it's the same, approximately $500, $400 to $500.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions for Dr. Gonison? All right, seeing none, thank you. I want to also just offer, in case anybody is interested, we have Assistant Attorney General Harriet Milks with us from the Department of Law. She's responsible for supporting the Board of Optometry, in case anybody has any questions. Do you have some remarks that you wanted to make, Assistant AG Milks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Harriet Milks from the Department of Law, and I just wanted to call to your attention a couple of things, if I may. I think you have in each of your packets a copy of the Administrative Regulations Drafting Manual. If you look at page 4 of that, there's a very handy flow chart that will show you the steps that boards go through when they adopt or propose to adopt regulations governing their profession. At every step of the way, the Department of Law is there to advise them and to assist them, particularly with process. What we don't do at the Department of Law is tell boards how to regulate their professions. That's their job. We don't get involved in issues of policy. We don't tell them what's good for their practitioners or what ought to happen with their licensees. What we do is make sure that the regulations they adopt and propose to adopt do two or three things. First, that they're constitutional, consistent with the Constitution, and that they are promulgated consistent with the Administrative Procedure Act, which sets out all of the procedures for the adoption of regulations. You can read that also on your own time, but I want to call to your attention, if I may, a couple of things that are very important about our work with the Administrative Procedure Act and licensing boards. One is that the entire process of adopting regulations is fully transparent to the public. And by public, I mean every single Alaskan gets to see what our licensing boards propose to adopt as regulations. What I do with the Department of Law is assist regulatory boards, licensing boards, healthcare boards like the optometrists, in making sure that their proposed regulations go out for public comment. They have to be noticed in the newspaper. They have to go on the Alaska Online Public Notice System. The public can submit questions that the board must answer if they're submitted on time. And the proposed regulations go to each one of you, plus interested people, professional licensing associations. So it's not a situation by any means where a board can promulgate regulations that it just writes sort of in the dark of night. It's very much a public process. And the Department of Law is there available to licensing boards, again, at every step of the way. Once the board, once the regulation is put out for public notice, the public comments come in, and by the way, regulations need to be put out for 30 days or more. The regulations comments come in, questions have been answered. The board will meet in a notice public meeting and discuss the public comments, take into consideration the public comments on its proposed regulations. Then if it adopts the regulation, it comes back to the Department of Law, goes through the regulations attorneys, and at that step, we look at the proposed regulation, the adopted regulation very, very, very carefully to make sure that it's constitutional, that it's not beyond the scope of the board's authority that you've given them in the underlying statute. So if I'd like to invite any questions you have about that, and I also would like, with your permission, just to make a comment about advisory opinions, which is something that is included in this bill.
Proceed.
I'll make that comment first then and see if you have any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. Advisory opinions are just that. They're advisory and they are opinions. They are observations about how practice might happen in a licensed program consistent with the regulation. They are not law. They don't come to the Department of Law for vetting. They are promulgated by the board in an effort to assist licensees. It's common knowledge, and you certainly, all of you, are very aware how in the particularly with the healthcare license programs, things change. There are new treatment modalities. There are issues that come up every day. School nurses have issues every day that we just can't anticipate. And so, for example, an advisory opinion might be requested by a school nurse who may ask, for example, the Board of Nursing, is it within the scope of my nursing practice to distribute homeopathic remedies? And in that particular case, the board said, no, that's not a nursing duty. That's not law. That's just the board looking, I don't want to say just, that's the board looking at the statute and saying, nowhere in the statute does it talk about nurses being part of their professional duties and authority being to distribute homeopathic remedies. So that's an advisory opinion. It doesn't have the force of law, doesn't come through the Department of Law. Of course, boards are always open. Certainly, they can ask the Department of Law to look at an advisory opinion. At that point, we may consider whether the advisory opinion is something that is better suited to a regulation, and then again, we go through the adoption process that's set out in the Administrative Procedure Act. That is all I can offer, and I would certainly make myself available to any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Milks. Does anybody on the committee have any questions for Ms. Milks while we have her? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I want to thank Ms. Milks, Drs. Gunnison and Barney. I looked backwards there. Sorry. And Ms. Nesmith for speaking to HB 103 today. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further consideration by the committee on Thursday afternoon at our next committee meeting at 3 p.m. Thank you very much. Now we're going to turn our attention to House Bill 174, extending the declaration of disaster emergency relating to the opioid epidemic. We're going to be hearing from the Department of Health and Social Services. Go ahead and have a seat, Dr. Butler, and then taking public testimony. Dr. Butler, if you can go ahead and put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health and Social Services, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I think everybody here is aware of the challenges we have with the opioid epidemic as a infectious disease person who tends to understate. I don't use the word epidemic very often, but anytime you have over a two-decade period a fourfold increase in a single cause of death, I think that fits the definition. In fact, I would submit that the current opioid situation is one of the more challenging emerging public health issues that we've had since HIV/AIDS emerged in the early 1980s. In late 2016, Department of Health and Social Services competed for and was awarded a five-year grant by the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to support an opioid overdose prevention program that includes distribution of naloxone, a drug that can be life-saving when administered to someone who stopped breathing because of an opioid overdose. The grant funds have been used to acquire a nasal spray form of the drug that is part of the rescue kits distributed through the Alaska Project HOPE, HOPE standing for Harm Reduction, Overdose Prevention, and Education. Project HOPE has prioritized partnerships with staff of organizations that do not have medical direction and who are most likely to have staff who are present when an overdose occurs, such as certain first responders and persons involved in recovery support. To provide the kits under a standing medical order, the department explored a number of options. We were advised by the Attorney General's office that the best option would be for the state medical officer to issue a standing order. The authority for the standing order would require a disaster declaration. I want to be clear, there's probably a number of mechanisms to achieve that authority, but this seemed to be the way to do it as quickly as possible to be able to respond to the emerging problem and take advantage of the federal resources that were available to us. Governor Walker issued the declaration on February 14th with an anticipated legislative concurrent resolution to extend the declaration longer than the 30-day duration defined by Alaska statute. No state general funds are requested to support Project HOPE. It is supported entirely by the federal grant over the next 5 years. Since the declaration, 12 partner organizations have received the training to be able to dispense the medication and provide the kits. And updating from yesterday, nearly 1,300 kits have been dispensed. This past Thursday, we learned the opinion of Ledge Legal that had a little different interpretation of the meaning of concurrent resolution, and their feeling that a bill is required to extend the declaration and continue distribution of the kits under the standing order. I really appreciate the chance to appear before you today and to discuss the bill. The bill is short and sweet. In a quick sectional analysis, Section 1 includes findings on the extent of the public health threat, acknowledges and describes the governor's disaster declaration and the need for the legislature to extend the declaration to address the epidemic. Section 2 extends the February 14, 2014 disaster declaration for 1 year to February 14, 2018. And Section 3 makes the effective date retroactive to March 15, 2017, when the current disaster declaration expires. Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to take questions.
Representative Johnston.
So this is mainly to distribute and use, Narcan.
Narcan's the brand name. Yeah. That's correct.
And otherwise, how else would you have been able to do it? You said there were other ways, but this seemed to be the most expedient way to distribute it?
Yes. Representative Johnston, through the chair, may I actually answer maybe two questions there. One is it is an FDA-approved drug, and it can be acquired under a physician's prescription. It is a prescription drug.
Right.
So to work with the partners in the program and distribute the overdose kits, It would require a standing order that could be done under the authority of my prescribing license. And the way that seemed to be the best route forward was to do it as part of a disaster declaration. If we want to really dig into the legal options and how did we come to this point, I might have to defer to Stacy Crayley sitting behind me, but I don't know if I've adequately addressed the question.
I'll trust you. This is the best way to do it. But are you also, with this declaration, going to be looking at getting further federal grants, or do you feel that our distribution, we're taking care of our distribution needs as is with HOPE?
Thank you for that question, Representative Johnston. Through the chair, the disaster declaration primarily achieves the goal of the standing order for the naloxone distribution. We are pursuing other grants and other non-GF funding sources, recognizing that given our fiscal situation that there really isn't a pool to dip into there. So we are looking at many options as possible to be able to respond to this issue.
Follow up. So this isn't needed to apply for those grants. You would have been able to do that anyways. So
Representative Johnston, that is correct, through the chair.
Thank you.
Representative Kito and then Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the bill as written extends the disaster declaration through February 14, 2018. What happens on February 15, 2018?
Representative Kito, through the chair, we would need to be looking at an additional extension, assuming that we're going to continue distributing under the standing order for the presumably the life of the grant.
And follow-up.
Follow-up.
So is there a designated time frame for the grant, or is it just until the money expires?
Representative Kito, thank you for that question. It is a five-year grant that was effective beginning, I believe, October 1st of 2016, so starting with the federal fiscal year. So we are about 5 months, a little more than 5 months, into the five-year grant now.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair, so how many heroin overdose deaths are we talking about in 2015?
Representative Eastman, in 2015, I believe the number was 38. I think there's an important caveat there, though, in that these are what we classify as heroin-associated, meaning that either the circumstances reflected heroin use immediately before death or 6-monoaminyl morphine, which is the metabolite of heroin, was detected in the postmortem specimen. It's not uncommon that people have multiple drugs on board at the time of death, oftentimes multiple opioids. So, you know, assigning a death specifically to heroin as opposed to, say, a prescription opioid can be a little tricky, but when we look at the trends, that's up from single digits in 2009. So the number of heroin doses have increased significantly in Alaska, pretty much mirroring what has been seen in other parts of the U.S. and Canada.
Follow-up?
Proceed.
Thank you. And through the chair, now at 38 deaths in 2015, what's our number in 2016?
2016, the number is a little higher again. It's in the 40s. I think some of the late year cases are not finalized yet, so I believe I'm fairly confident in saying it's going to be somewhere in the mid-40s. It's going to be a little higher.
When do we find out those numbers?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, funny, I was just asking that question myself a few hours ago. I would hope to have that before the end of the month. Last year, 2015, we had those numbers before the end of March also. Actually had them publicly available by March 24th.
Okay. Representative Sullivan-Leonard.
Thank you. I just wanted to segue onto my colleague's question. Since many times heroin and opioid are joined together, are your statistics then showing, for example, 2015, deaths of 38 Alaskans. Is that heroin-related only, or is it heroin and opioid and yeah. or?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair. Those are cases that were related to heroin. Overall, I think the best numbers say there were more than 80 that were some type of opioid-associated death. So prescription opioids are frequently used and sometimes used interchangeably. Among people nationally who use heroin, though, about 80% report that they start with prescription opioids.
Right. That's the distinction I was looking for. Thank you, sir.
Dr. Butler, I have a question for you. You described earlier the Project Hope grant is a five-year grant, and the one-year declaration, disaster declaration extension that we're reviewing here in HB 174 is for 1 year. Are you hoping to come back again in a year, or are we just not sure what the best tool is to utilize for distribution after year one?
Madam Chairman, I would say I'm not sure the best mechanism. I'd be happy to turn it over to Stacy to dig into that a little further, but basically whatever will get us there. I've just been handed a note.
We'll give you a moment to read it.
Oh my gosh. Okay, sure. Maybe this may be a little bit, I'm not sure this reiterate or just clarifying the earlier statements, but the current state law does not provide for the authority for the state medical officer to issue standing orders. So that was the reason for the disaster declaration, right. Going back to the earlier testimony. So this is really a short-term fix for what may be a longer-term, prelude to a longer-term administrative fix. And fair enough?
Fair enough. Through the chair, my name is Stacy Crayley. I'm Chief Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Law. I concur with what Dr. Butler just said. This was due to the emergency nature of the event and needing the emergency declaration to administer and to issue the standing orders. We do believe that there's an additional statutory fix that will need to be done that does not necessarily require an extension of this bill next year, but we will need to find the authority for Dr. Butler to issue these standing orders. It was an oversight in the passage of Senate Bill 23 last year, which created the mechanism for providing the naloxone distribution, and there was a gap in there where standing orders were authorized, but it didn't kind of connect the dots between the chief medical officer and the standing orders. So we need to fix that, and we intend on doing so.
Okay, so this is an intermediate remedy then, perhaps what we're looking at here in terms of HB 174 is an intermediate remedy, and we'll look at a longer-term remedy.
Through the chair,
next
yes.
year. Okay, thank you. Is there any other questions? Oh, okay. Representative Eastman?
Oh, thank you. Through the chair. Now, if the process by which this bill is being passed does not go through, how would you look at attending to this issue, and explain to us some of the difficulties or the time frame dealing with pursuing maybe a memorandum of agreement instead of this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, If this bill does not pass, we are in a gap phase. There will be no authority for Dr. Butler to issue these standing orders. So these kits will not, once the deadline for the emergency declaration expires, we will be at a loss of a further administration. Now, other licensed providers can issue standing orders, but as to what Dr. Butler is trying to achieve in terms of providing standing orders for first responders and for some of the opioid action committees in different communities, those will not be able to be effectuated. So we would need a statutory change of some sort in order to have this authorization, be that through this, which is an emergency intermediate step to avoid this gap that we're having, so we can move to a longer-term fix. We need a statute to do this.
Follow-up?
Proceed.
Through the chair. So help me understand, what could you accomplish if you pursued memorandums of agreement instead of a statutory change?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, absent finding licensed physicians who are able to step in and provide some of the oversight and standing order services, I don't believe the memorandums of understanding or agreement would get us very far. We need a licensed physician to issue the standing order. That's a standard practice. And absent the a physician who's willing to step in and do that for these different entities and agencies, we would be, as I said, in a rather large gap period, and there would not be a way to administer these kits.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Representative Edgman, I believe you had a question.
Yeah, so thank you for all your work on this issue. And I know it's supported by the Opioid Task Force and all the great work that's been done there. I noticed the bill has a zero fiscal note. And in reading Section 6, there's discussion about establishing a statewide overdose response program and coordination between the department and yourself, Dr. Butler. So at the risk of being somewhat facetious, my question is, knowing the underlying sort of foundational elements of opioid drug abuse, how much teeth does this actually have in it? And I pose that as a sincere question. I'm not trying to undermine the efforts of the bill, but if this is drawing on existing resources from the department, admittedly, and then also local and regional programs, and then knowing the extent of, or at least something, knowing a little bit about the depth of the opioid problem and how there's other sort of symptomatic mm-hmm. conditions and so forth, this is going to be effective because you're going to get the naloxone drug out to more people who need it, and it's going to be dispensed in a more expeditious manner. But I'm wondering, and maybe give you an opportunity to talk about this, establishing a statewide overdose response program, and really, again, how much teeth does it have in it?
Sure. Representative Edgman, through the chair, or I should say Vice Chair Edgman, if by teeth you mean the impact on health, mm-hmm. this by itself will not get us where we need to be. Mm-hmm. This is a valuable tool for saving a life. It does not cure addiction. So the broader response needs to include addressing access to care for people who struggle with addiction, destigmatizing addiction, helping everyone get a better understanding that addiction is a condition of the brain that needs to be managed as a chronic health condition, and then also addressing some of the environmental drivers, which include things like how we manage pain, the amount of opioid pain relievers that are in the community, and particularly if Representative Carr was here, I would be spanked if I didn't say addressing some of the drivers for self-medication, such as adverse childhood experiences. So that's a very broad response because mm-hmm. there really is no magic bullet. The fiscal note is focused entirely on Project HOPE, which is the overdose death prevention program. So that is funded solely by the SAMHSA grant, which is a little over $4.1 million over a five-year period. The actual personnel to support that has been with the staff that we have in the division now. Myself, plus really across the division as part of the response that, of course, we're now doing in an incident command structure, seeing this as a probably a long-term emergency response, just as we might think of after a major natural disaster, how we might use incident command structure to coordinate and communicate during the prolonged recovery phase after that incident.
And Madam Chair, just a follow-up, I brought my point up only because it's not that I'm skeptical of this effort. I support it completely, and I want to see the bill get through as quickly as possible. But I also know, and it's good that the Commissioner can come up and maybe help set me straight here a little bit, but I'm also just skeptical in the broader sense, knowing that we passed major legislation last year, actually two pieces, Senate Bill 74 dealing with this sort of a subset of this issue here, and then of course Senate Bill 91 with tied to criminal justice reform. But both those bills are predicated on really providing treatment to those that need treatment. And so I can view this as the tip of the spear, but the spear itself is it's perhaps not getting the resources that it adequately deserves in order to effectively not only combat this problem, but the overall problem of substance abuse in Alaska, which drives so many things that we're talking about in the fiscal crisis, as well as a lot of things in this committee. And so perhaps a little bit more than we all bargained for in terms of an editorial comment, but I wanted to put that on the record in the sort of a perhaps a perverse way of supporting your bill.
Well, if I could comment, Representative Edgman, through the chair, I appreciate the comment because I think it captures the complexity of the issue and that it's important that we not become single molecule focused. Still, alcohol kills more Alaskans than opioids. So why are we here talking about opioids? Well, there's a couple reasons. Alcohol deaths have not increased that dramatically and still continue to increase. I also don't have a tool like this for alcohol-related mortality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Commissioner, would you like to speak to the issue?
Brianna, Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Edgman, you're exactly right. This bill alone, as Dr. Butler testified, will not solve the problem. Really, the department is taking a multifaceted approach. We've applied for every federal dollar that we possibly can. We've secured four federal grants that are designed to do different things. This one is to administer an immediate life-saving intervention for folks who are in active overdose. There's an additional federal grant that is really about education and prevention to make sure that people understand the dangers of opioids. There are a number of grants that are out there that we've also applied for that will allow for treatment services. The legislature also made funds available last year through the budgetary process. The Set Free Alaska in the Valley is actually was awarded a grant to be able to provide treatment for women with children for up to a 16-bed facility to be able to do treatment. Also, there's a detox facility. The Central Peninsula Hospital also received a grant to be able to provide for immediate detox services. And the department has also recently applied, I think last week, for a $2 million grant that would allow for medication-assisted treatment that will administer a medication that will assist folks to be able to stay clean, combined with therapy that's available, really that gets to the root of the problem that Dr. Butler mentioned earlier, which was, why are people self-medicating? Mm-hmm. And there is no magic pill. There is no magic treatment. Those things really do go together. The other piece was the piece included in Senate Bill 74, the 1115 behavioral health waiver that the department is pursuing. One of the things that really provides the department is a really complete redesign of our behavioral health system because we recognize that there are gaps in our continuum of care. We've been working with stakeholders for the last year, really looking at what's the best place for us to be able to provide those services. What are we missing? Can we intervene sooner? The other piece that's also really critical for a state like Alaska is under federal law, Alaska has been disproportionately impacted by a federal law that changed a number of years ago that precluded facilities that have more than 16-bed facilities. There was the Institutions for Mental Disease prohibition that didn't allow larger facilities to be able to seek reimbursement for Medicaid. And we have received guidance from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare and Medicaid Services that if we have an existing 1115 waiver, they will allow us to amend that waiver to be able to waive the IMD exclusion, which means larger facilities that are interested in providing treatment services can bill for Medicaid for those services, which means the more payers we have available, combined with these federal grants that are available and other opportunities, we recognize that there are many paths to recovery, and this allows us to be able to maximize those opportunities.
Representative Keita.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Davidson, one of the things, and it's not exactly on track with this bill, but you mentioned it, and I've heard it mentioned in a couple of other hearings as well, and that's the limitation on 16 beds for treatment. Can you explain perhaps what the motivation behind limiting treatment facilities to 16 beds was from the federal government's perspective?
Through the chair, Representative Keito, it used to be that that individuals, and this is a federal law, it used to be that individuals who experienced severe mental illness were pretty much institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And Congress, in their wisdom, recognized that that wasn't, you know, housing people basically for serious mental illness was not the most efficacious way to be able to support people, that really we in order to provide better service, we should treat people in the least restrictive environment as possible. Unfortunately, in that zeal to be able to protect that interest, I think folks in the treatment community, especially for substance use disorder treatment, recognize that that law has gone a little bit too far, which meant we had the unintended consequence of facilities that were larger that were providing for substance use treatment disorders, including alcohol, including opioids, including a whole host of substance use disorders, were unfortunately impacted in what my mother still calls the United States of America or the lower 48. They have a larger economy of scale, they can build smaller facilities, and they do just fine. In Alaska, the more buildings you have, the more you have to heat, the more you lose that economy of scale, especially when our practice in Alaska has been generally larger facilities, and that has impacted our ability to be able to provide more treatment services. So.
Just as a quick follow-up, it seems as though that smaller facilities have higher incremental costs, and then we have higher incremental costs up here. It seems like we should be able to do something in Alaska just as a blanket to maybe address that issue in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm looking at this disaster emergency declaration and what's being asked here, and referencing the fact that there were 38 heroin-related deaths a year ago, also remembering that there were 34 homicides in Anchorage. So by numbers, of course, statewide there was more than 34 homicides. So that would make it a murder epidemic in Alaska, which would be interesting. Now, I have worked in emergencies for most of my life, and for the state disaster management, and is well familiar with the declaration process. Now, historically, the Disaster Act was designed so that in cases of urgent need, we could bypass the normal appropriations process and the slow nature of that and give the governor, the administration, the opportunity to act decisively and quickly without some of the bureaucracy that normally goes along with the budgeting process. I see a zero fiscal note, but I also see a declaration, which my understanding of that declaration is that would open up the ability for the governor in the future to have a greater access to funds, to move them around. I'm wondering how hard it might be to resist that temptation if that's, in fact, what we're offering here through this bill. Is that what we're offering here?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if you look at Governor Walker's original disaster declaration, it was actually drafted extremely narrowly and limited the resources available to the state to those of the federal SAMHSA grant. One of the reasons this bill has a zero fiscal note is because the original disaster declaration limited it to only those federal resources that are available through that specific grant.
Follow-up?
Proceed.
Thank you. Through the chair. And because of these limited resources and the fact that this is kind of a stopgap, you know, one-year solution to a problem that I'm sure we'll all insist is going to last longer than a year, probably longer than the 5 years available in the grant, what is that next step? I mean, help me understand, if this goes through, this will last a year, what are our options?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I guess a couple of things could happen. One is the challenge that we have before us now is that the chief medical officer does not currently have the authority in state statute to be able to provide standing orders. We wish he did. For folks who are not his employees, I think that that's a challenge. So what we're trying to do is ensure that our partner organizations who are community-based organizations like Haven House and other organizations like Set Free, other folks who may not have a medical director, who may not have a physician who it can write a standing order for them, they should be able to use, we would like them to be able to use the standing orders of the chief medical officer, limited to being able to distribute these naloxone kits, thank you. So really what we're trying to do is make sure that we can get as many of these kits out there as possible to as many grassroots organizations in every community of the state as quickly as possible. A longer-term solution is to be able to provide the chief medical officer, I won't say Dr. Butler because you won't always be the chief medical officer. We wish you could be, but you won't always. To be able to have the authority to issue standing orders when necessary.
A brief follow-up.
Proceed.
Thank you. Through the chair. Now, if there is no medical director at that local level and you would, in effect, be standing in for the medical director, I work under a medical director in my profession, wouldn't that mean that you would be incurring liability in the case that there were mishaps when those were administered?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I certainly would not be taking this on apart from the protections that are afforded under SB 23, which really focuses on establishing some of the guidelines around how to do the requires training, which is part of why you know, we're starting fairly slow in terms of bringing partners on board, providing the training to them, as well as developing the trainer activities, which is a longer, of course, several hour course that we provide to people who be able to do that. In the case of, for instance, EMS personnel, they have medical direction, they're already carrying it, and so that's not a focus of the project, Hope.
Thank you.
Sure. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a few comments, and first of all, thank you for having this movement of getting these emergency kits out to the public. If we had had this kind of personal to me, but about 8 years ago, I would have had a family member that was here today. However, your work in my community in the Matsu Valley, they're making headway. They're getting out into areas that normally haven't been covered, and for that, I thank you. I sincerely thank you and appreciate those efforts. I also know, too, when we talk about the emergency aspect of situations that come up and how this Narcan can help. You know, we also have to remember we have EpiPens out there too for people that have allergic reactions to different substances. So the more that we can get the training out there in our various communities, I think the more effect we're going to make on the general public, the more education we can have interspersed in our communities. I know that that will help also. But I know, too, that the next step after this has to be a way to fight this terrible epidemic. So thank you.
Sorry. Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard. I appreciate your comments. If that's, do we have any more questions on the committee? All right. I'd like to, do you have a show and tell that you'd like to do? Okay. I'd like to go ahead and welcome our public testimony. I know that we have some people that have been waiting on the off-net for some time. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify before we move to the off-net? Thank you, both of you. All right, seeing none, I'm going to go to Andy Jones with the Division of Public Health. Is Mr. Jones on just for questions, or? All right, that was just for questions. Talia Walters with Fallonet Ministries in Palmer.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you, Ms. Walters.
Okay, all right, thank you. So I'm Talia Walters, and I'm the president and founder of Fallonet Ministries, and I'm also part of the Massey Opioid Task Force, and Fallonet Ministries is one of the organizations that took the training for the Narcan, and I wanted to give a little bit of personal testimony of, you know, why we do what we do, and I'm a person in long-term recovery, and I'm boots on the ground a lot, along with a lot of individuals that are, you know, part of the task force and part of Fallonet Ministries. And I see individuals that are in active addiction, and we talked about, I heard Dr. Butler talk about, you know, the 38 deaths, and then compared to 40 deaths the next year. But is that a calculation of those who have lived that have been, had to have Narcan administered to them? So it's a huge issue, and the reason why I support House Bill 174 is because the lack of resources. Today, I did an assessment for somebody with our Lazarus Project, which we are trying to provide resources for detox. And because of the lack of resources in the state, a lot of individuals will continue to use and take the risk of overdosing. And so, in the meantime, while we're trying to create these resources, we definitely need the Narcan available so that if somebody does overdose, that we can revive them. Right now, we are currently doing a detox project, but that only is going to serve 25 patients for data collection on the protocol that the Massey Opioid Task Force has come up with. In the meantime, we definitely support having individuals in the community that are actually dealing with addicts and talking to them to be able to have access to that Narcan that they're still using. My son was an addict, and he was murdered a year and a half ago, and there was many times that I watched my son use, plus he was diabetic, where I've had to, like, revive him because he forgot to eat and so on and so forth. But and I have nearly 12 years clean and sober from opioid addiction myself, and I have overdosed. And thank God I didn't die, but just remembering having that overdose and how other people have dealt with it in the community or in their addiction, putting them in a bathtub, ice, all of that stuff, and then calling 911, you know, and sometimes that can be too late. Here we are 20 years later. I know that when I started my opioid addiction 20 years ago with a prescription of OxyContin for pain management, I wanted to, so desperately to get off of the opioids, and was turned away many times from the emergency department, and here we are 20 years later still stuck in the same situation, but this time we are losing people. In this nation, we calculated 129 people die every single day in the United States from a drug overdose. It's like a jet plane going down every day. So it is a disaster, and this is a huge issue in our state. And I just encourage using this to pass this, because while we are trying to create these resources, we still need people to be able to not end up dying from an overdose.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Walters, I'd like to thank you for your testimony. I'd also like to congratulate you on your sobriety. 12 years is something to be extremely proud of. I also want to thank you for your very public leadership on this issue. I know that you were one of the women that went back east to make sure that our national delegation was well aware of the issue, and that you helped to organize the health summit that I was able to attend last summer. Your leadership has had a very tangible impact on our state already. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Mark Weaver, are you on the phone? Could you go ahead and introduce yourself, state in the association, and begin your testimony?
My name is Mark Weaver. I am the vice president of Fallout Ministries. I'm a board member of Real About Addiction. I'm a member of the MAT2 Opiate Task Force since the very first public meeting we've had. And I will also be one of the people that is helping to put together the Anchorage Opioid Task Force starting next month. And I also am calling in to urge the passing of HB 174. My personal testimony, I could tell you story after story about people we've lost, but I'd really like to highlight one of my good friends, Sarah, who is a peer-to-peer support specialist that is also clean sober and breathing life into individuals and boots on the ground like the rest of us, helping to direct people to the resources that we do have available. And I think a gap in this disaster declaration would just be ridiculous. I mean, I look at Narcan as like having a defibrillator at the ice rink, as having fire extinguishers in commercial trucks and in malls, and like having seatbelts. I mean, it's just, to me, it's just kind of a no-brainer. If we can save a life, you know, from there we can help direct those individuals to the resources we have available to get them on the track to making good choices. And, you know, by training the trainers, we can get more people to help us spread the word and show others how to get out of the entrapment of addiction. And so I'm uniquely positioned to affect lives of people that our representatives can't, just as Taria, just as other people that will undoubtedly testify today. We're all uniquely positioned in places that we can bring information, spread life, and we can get these Narcan kits. I mean, I can get them out to ADAC, you know? I mean, there's so many people that, you know, don't live in downtown Anchorage, don't live in downtown Juneau, don't live in downtown Wasilla, that are struggling. So we don't want to fall backwards. We want to keep moving forward with the progress that we've made and utilize the federal funds that have become available. And we just want to help you all to help our community. So that's my testimony for today. I appreciate the chance to testify. I'd also like to add that most of us involved with what I do are volunteers. We don't get paid to sit on hold and wait to testify before you guys. And so that's how important this is to us. So thank you.
Mr. Weaver, thank you very much for taking the time out to do this and also for your service to our community. Thank you very much. Is Serena Espinoza on the phone?
Yes, hi.
All right, can you introduce yourself and any associations you have before proceeding with your testimony?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Serena Espinoza. I'm the vice president of Real About Addiction, and I am the board administrator for Fallen Up Ministries, and I'm also a member of the MAT2 Opiate Task Force and will be a member of the Anchorage Opiate Task Force. And as someone that is at the, you know, at the front lines that are dealing with, you know, recovery and addiction, I'm seeing too many accidental overdose deaths. And those deaths add up to so many Alaskans that would have gotten a chance at recovery had they had access to this life-saving drug, Narcan. In order for us to continue this advocacy work we do and help our Alaskans, we need to be able to distribute Narcan and have continued access to it. I believe all nonprofits, treatment facilities, medical providers, emergency responders, recovery advocates, and even families of addicts will play an important role with saving the life of an Alaskan so long as we have the immediate access to these HOPE kits. The other component of the project HOPE is the medication disposal bags, which also will play a huge role in prevention and help keep opiates out of the hands of our youth and those who could have access to it by just, you know, being able to destroy opiates within these disposal kits. And, you know, Terry was just on the line, and Mark, they are my longtime friends, and I work with them every day. And every single thing that they just testified, I am right there with them. Like Mark said, we volunteer because this is our passion, and we want to save people in our state. And it's possible because we all recover, and we all have the chance at it, but we have to be able to save lives. And I believe every life is worth saving, not just within our state, but, you know, in the world. And Narcan will continue to play a very important role in the work we do, and I really strongly ask that you guys help us save lives, and I support this bill. I'm hoping that this will continue so we can continue to save lives of Alaskans.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Espinoza, and for your service to our community.
Thank you.
Tara Nelson from Juneau, are you on the phone?
Hi, this is Karen Alton.
Super. Can you introduce yourself before proceeding with your testimony?
Sure. I am the director of Haven House Juneau, which is a faith-based peer-led recovery residence for women who are coming back to their community after incarceration. I'm also a person in long-term recovery, and what that means is I haven't used a drink or a drug since June 1st, 2011. And that really puts my professional hat and my personal life together. I do work for a recovery residence, and we are a partnership with the HOPE Project, and it's something that we don't just utilize within our home, but we have such a connection with so many women in our community that come to us, whether they're trying to navigate the treatment gauntlet, or whether they're coming to us because they would like to live in a safe and sober home, or the fact that we pretty much have contact with every single woman and many men who exit our prison here in Juneau, and it's a necessary tool that we use. Obviously, it's not the only tool, but as I heard some other of my colleagues talk about, my dear friends up the Mount Sioux area. You know, we do this because it's a lifestyle and because we're on the ground level and we're talking to hundreds of people a month and providing peer support services as volunteers. And so our voices are very relevant in this battle that we're in and very relevant in bringing solutions to our state. And so I am in absolute support of the extension of the governor's declaration of disaster to address the opioid epidemic, and I spoke a little bit yesterday as well, a little bit more emotional, but I really want to reiterate that, you know, this is a real place of hope for not just the nonprofits and the different organizations who are really taking a stand and rising up to have the different support to battle addiction, but also you know, the declaration of emergency just allows many of us that are out here on the ground level to continue moving forward and connecting each other and really utilizing the disaster declaration to come together in a way that we have to, because we have so many people out there dying and so many people that are being saved right now today with the utilization of Narcan. I unfortunately was at a scene of a overdose just a few weeks back, and you know, that doesn't leave you. I've also overdosed myself several times. We deal with the ER at times, you know, when they have someone there, they'll just call us, knowing that we work in the recovery field. And so, you know, it goes so much deeper than just getting Project Hope and keeping that out. That's a huge piece, and we're a proud partner there. I just really encourage everyone to continue moving forward and understanding that we're hitting so many barriers as it is, and we don't need any more barriers. We really are the solution, and we're doing the work. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. Nelson, and congratulations on your 6.5 years of sobriety, as well as your leadership in the recovery community here in Juneau and throughout the state. John Green, are you available on the phone?
Yes, hi, and thank you. My name is John Green. I'm also a member of the Massachusetts Task Force. I'm the father of Kelsey Green. My daughter was an addict, and because of the gauntlet of trying to find resources or anything like that as a last resort, we had my daughter arrested. She died 5 days later in an Anchorage jail from detoxing, complications from detoxing. Really, getting into recovery, it really is an obstacle. There's a lot of barriers. There's a lot of, you would think that there's a lot of places out there, but there's a lot of them that are men-only. There's a lot of them that require proof of income. And if you're stealing to buy dope, you probably don't have an income. A lot of them have waiting lists. And you know, it's just really daunting for a parent to try to find, you know, some place to get your kid into recovery and to help them. You know, having said that, you know, while there are many obstacles, you know, just being alive shouldn't be one of them. So that's why I support moving forward with this declaration to allow for the Narcan to be administered. You know, there's a perception that the people that are for recovery are really soft on crime, but I just want to clear that up for anybody. Having the option to get into recovery is actually better for the community and for public safety, because once an addict is recovered, they're a productive member of society, and they aren't going to continue their criminal behavior. There's also a perception, I think, with some, and I heard it yesterday at the hearing, that giving Narcan to somebody will give them an excuse to use more. And it makes them more careless in their, you know, with their use. And I think that's like having an airbag in your car and deciding you're going to drive into a tree to see if it's going to work. You know, nobody wants to overdose and die. So what this really does is it gives people a chance to live and to get into recovery and to a lot of those people are going to become recovery advocates, and they're going to help other addicts out of this mess. So, anyway, that's pretty much my testimony. I definitely hope that we will push this forward and get on to administering the Narcan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Before you leave the phone, Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question for you.
Hi, John.
Yeah.
Hi. Just wanted to call and say thank you for all of your work in Mat-Su, for what you went through, and certainly the terrible loss that you have suffered. You've turned around to work in our community to help get the word out and communicate and educate other families who have young daughters that may possibly be in your situation that you were in the past. So thank you, sir. I appreciate that. And I'll continue to keep working with you in Mat-Su.
Thank you.
I share in Representative Sullivan Leonard's commendations of your work. Thank you, Mr. Green. Is Chris Eaton still on the phone? All right. It looks like Chris is offline. So I don't see anybody new has joined us in the room, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. I remember the gavel. Ted Madsen will be very pleased with me. So this bill is an urgent and important piece of legislation, and as Commissioner Davidson referenced earlier, it is but a very small piece of an overall much broader strategy. I think that Speaker and Vice Chair Edgeman described it as the tip of the spear
It is, however, extremely urgent. In my opinion, we have an emergency disaster declaration that has expired, essentially, if I'm correct in sort of understanding where we are on the dates, or could be expiring by the end of today, tomorrow. It'll expire tomorrow. I would consider a motion to advance this from committee at this point in time, although I would not typically do so. It's generally my policy, and I've described that before, that I prefer to wait. But in this case, because this bill is very limited in scope, it has a zero fiscal note, and could help the department continue to administer a life-saving drug, a drug that's been compared by some of our testimony today as a defibrillator for those that are suffering from opioid addiction. I would welcome a motion.
Madam Chair, I would, I don't know if Representative Eastman had a comment, but I was going to make the motion. I would move House Bill 174, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations in the attached zero fiscal note.
Any objection? Would you like to speak to your objection?
Well, yes, actually. I have a question for the commissioner, if we could ask her to come back up.
Commissioner Davidson? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. And sorry, kind of the pace of things, haven't been able to get to you to ask this question offline, but I just now reviewed the governor's disaster declaration from February 14th, and reference each of the citations you looked up. Now, I had understood from what you said earlier that the declaration or some portion of it limited authority to the federal program in some way. And I wasn't able to see in the declaration kind of what was going on there. Can you point it out to me or help me understand?
Sorry, we're playing musical chairs.
Thank you.
No problem.
Through the chair, Stacey Crayley, Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Eastman. When the emergency declaration was crafted or drafted, it was drafted, as Commissioner Davidson said, very narrowly. And within the construct of the statutory authorization under the, I think it's title, got it here, Title 36, or under Military and Veterans Affairs, under Title 26, there's the mechanism about how you craft this emergency order. There's a companion statute under Title 18 that allows the department to use this framework in crafting a public health emergency, which is what we did. So we took the authorization under Title 18, went to Title 26, and the documentation that was presented to the governor and then also to the legislature through the notices when the emergency declaration was issued provides the fiscal analysis with the actual declaration that identifies how the money is limited to the federal grant. It was crafted very narrowly to make sure it was clear we weren't seeking any additional fiscal impact. And so if you look at the entire packet and the documentation that is required under Alaska Statute 2623020 and the framework that was sent to the legislature with that declaration, all of that encompasses that detail.
Follow up?
Proceed.
Thank you. Well, I'm looking at all the information that I have, which is the governor's letter and the fiscal note and the declaration itself, and I don't think I have that part of it because all I see is a declaration, which I'm fairly familiar with the verbiage. It seems pretty standard, and it authorizes, you know, certain things to happen, and I think the actual statute that's being activated here says all state resources are now at the governor's disposal for this. Am I reading the wrong declaration here?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, no, you're not. The statutory authorization does contemplate a broad array of authority to the governor to trigger all sorts of additional authorities to address an emergency such as what you're describing. What we did and how we drafted it, and when you look at the opioid disaster finance plan, we limited the funding to the $4.1 million that Dr. Butler testified to. It was very clear within the conversations with the governor's office and then again through the letter that was sent to the leadership of both both bodies here that we were not seeking any additional authorizations under the statute, which would have normally been able to be triggered. We're not seeking any additional authorizations, just simply the authority for the standing order and to administer this five-year grant. And we can certainly provide that additional documentation if to the committee, but it was all provided within the construct of the original declaration.
Thank you. That would be helpful since I'm being asked to vote on this.
Mm-hmm. Representative Eastman, do you have the fiscal note?
I do have the fiscal note, yes.
Okay, I believe that addresses it.
Is that it, or is there more outside the fiscal note?
Through the chair, there was a budget document that was created that we presented, and so we can certainly provide, we can provide that to the committee for as... Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There was a budget document that was created.
Okay. Thank you. Do you maintain your objection?
I do.
All right, clerk, can you call the roll?
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
No.
Representative Johnston.
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Yes.
Representative Tarr. Representative Keto.
Yes.
Chair Sponholz.
Yes.
Five yeas, one nay.
All right. Thank you, everyone. And with that, the bill passes. No. All right. Don't forget to stay and sign the committee paperwork. On Thursday, we will be hearing a presentation from Facing Foster Care in Alaska. We'll hear HB 151 and other legislation which has been previously heard or scheduled. And then finally, don't forget on Saturday, we'll be having a hearing this Saturday, the 18th, covering HB 159, the governor's omnibus legislation confronting the opioid epidemic in Alaska and potentially other bills previously heard or scheduled. The time is 4:48, and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee meeting is now adjourned. I keep saying committee.